Well, one of our favorite guests on Coast to Coast AM, L.A. Marzulli, one of the best, and we're going to talk about his latest work, Watchers 4, On the Edge, the Nephilim Giants. What does it all mean? Stick around and find out on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, L.A. Marzulli, best-selling author of the Nephilim Trilogy, and also several DVDs out there, including Watchers 1, 2, 3, and now 4, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. L.A., how are you?
Great, George. Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Always a pleasure. You are one of our favorite guests,
my friend.
I
appreciate that.
Time and time again. Good job, by the way, with Watchers 4.
Thank you, sir.
Tell me how that whole concept came about.
Well, with all due respect to certain other media groups, which I won't mention any names, I don't want to get in trouble here, but I was on a one particular show, and I was interviewed for about 3 hours the first time and 3 hours the second time, and I was just amazed on, and you know, look, when someone produces a show, it's their dime, and
that's right,
they can do whatever they want, and I understand that, but what kind of blew me away is the fact that all this information, I mean, there was just hours and hours and hours of information was just edited. So I went to my friend, who is now a director and producer of The Watchers, Richard Shaw, and I said, let's create something. And that's how this whole thing started. And Nexus, you know, was not get mad, let's kind of get even, let's just do our own show. And so we really had a war chest of $0 and, you know, two hardworking guys. I penned most of the music, and Richard actually cut the first show on his laptop, if you can believe that. And that's sort of the beginning of the whole thing. And here we are. 4 has been out. We're actually working on 5.
Wow.
It should be out probably by the end of October, November.
Who are the Watchers, Ellie?
Well, it's sort of a play on words. the Watchers are actually a group of angels, and they're very mysterious. We read in prophetic texts and the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, that there was a group of watcher angels. It's like a class of angelic beings. It's not the normal everyday 9-to-5 angelic being, if I could use those terms. It's something that has a very specific purpose. And apparently these guys watch and they kind of rule over certain areas. We only get a glimpse of this stuff. This is what's so sort of maddening about when you get into the whole guidebook of the supernatural and you start looking at this stuff. And you look at the protocols of what's going on, we get glimpses. We don't get the whole picture. You know, the manual is like extremely incomplete, and we only get little glimpses of things. So these watcher angels are certainly talked about in the Tanakh. Also, the Book of Enoch and other pseudepigraphical texts or ancient texts refer to them. But it's basically a class of angels. So we kind of took that. And I know David Flynn's been on your show. He's not with us anymore.
Yeah.
And he's sort of like, you know, when the rest of us were sort of cutting our teeth on this, Flynn had his website up, Watch Your Website. And I took that name and sort of honor, you know, giving honor to David for what all the incredible work that he did while he was with us. And then I kind of twisted it a little bit and said, well, you know, we're the watchers. We're modern day. We're watching all this stuff
unfold.
Yeah, unfold and writing about it and filming about it. And that's what Richard and I do.
These angels, were they good angels or bad ones?
Well, that's where it gets kind of bizarre. Yeah, the angels in the Tanakh seem to be good ones, okay? But the ones that come down in the Book of Enoch, the 200 watcher angels, which wound up on Mount Hermon, and that in itself is just, you know, we get the location. And this is the work of David Flynn. We've talked about this before. I'll just spill the beans early, I guess. But when you take the geo opposite of, remember, this is all David Flynn's work. When you go from Mount Hermon where these 200 watcher angels descended, and you go to the polar opposite, you wind up in Roswell, New Mexico. And to me, that is so absolutely deliberate. Something's going on there. And Flynn put that together, which is just astounding. When he wrote his paper on it, I remember, you know, the whole UFO community was, wow, look at that, because something's going on here. And he, you know, traced it back to antiquity, did the homework, did the math, showed how it works, and, you know, sort of the rest is history, the work of David Flynn. Hats off to David.
So is it possible, you know, we're going to talk about a lot of things tonight, we're going to cover a lot of ground, but is it possible that these 200 angels might have been extraterrestrials.
I knew you were going to ask that. And that
I mean, it sounds like also some of the work of Sitchin.
Exactly. And Eric von Daniken and the rest and all the crew in Ancient Aliens. This is, look, we all know something's going on. We all agree on that, you know.
That's right.
If you sat us in a room and said, you know, are we being visited? We'd all say, yes, we are. The difference comes to what paradigm are we going to embrace that best explains the phenomenon. And I look at the Ancient Alien astronaut theory, and the first question I would you know, throw out, hey, if we're in a digital simulation, there are no extraterrestrials. If the universe as we know it and the fabric of the universe is actually a digital simulation,
mm-hmm.
and we actually talked to one scientist, which I can't name because he doesn't want to be associated with the Watchers Project, but we asked to film him because he's come up with some fascinating, I guess, equations that he discovered, and he just went, wait, this can't be here. There's error-correcting software in the fabric of the universe. Look, I don't pretend to understand that. I'm not a quantum physicist. But, you know, we talked to him about it on the phone, and, you know, he explained it in sort of layman's terms, and we're just kind of sitting there going, you've got to be kidding me.
With your mouths open.
Yeah, exactly. Jaw on the ground. And look, if we're in a digital simulation, there might not be anything out there. We might be it. In that case, the whole theory of extraterrestrials falls of its own weight.
Well, there are some that think we are just it.
Well, you mean the time travel thing?
No, I mean they just, in terms of very spiritual, religious people, they think we're the only existence out in the universe.
Look, we could be. And at the same time, I have no clue. If we're in a digital simulation, then, okay, it gets kind of iffy.
Well, explain that a little bit more.
Okay. You know how The Matrix, the movie, is?
Yes, great movie.
Very similar to that. Let's say we're in literally a matrix, and that when we and what's interesting, and if we talk about this a little bit in Watchers 4, I don't want to keep plugging that, but one of the guys we interviewed, Howard Storm, he was taken someplace. He found himself in another reality, the realm of spirit, a very dark place he was at. And so, I mean, look, he was out of his body. He saw that, and what he experienced, an NDE, near-death experience, was profound. So there seems to be a greater reality than the one that we know and you know, deal with on a daily basis. He popped out of that for a brief period of time. His senses were heightened, hearing, eyesight, everything totally heightened. I mean, just the awareness was amazing. Instead of seeing like 180 degrees, he could see somehow 360 degrees all around him. How's that possible?
It's not possible.
How's that possible?
Yeah. Well,
not with the equipment that we have.
If we're in, though, this digital age, who created it?
That's the $64,000 question, isn't it?
It sure is.
I mean, look, when I've been doing some research on the whole DNA, deoxyribonucleic double spiral, which is just outrageous. And when Crick discovered DNA, Watson and Crick, and Crick looks at this thing, and this guy was an evolutionist. He was a Darwinist. And he looks at DNA, and he just kind of – and he was blown away by it. He was bowled over by it. And it vexed him, literally vexed him. It's like, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense that such a complex piece of information is found here. I mean, it makes no sense that this thing just evolved. There has to be some kind of designer behind it. And, of course, that's what the ancient astronaut, ancient alien paradigm is all about, that we were seeded in another galaxy by a race of extraterrestrials who somehow evolved, and it's kind of circular reasoning. Well, who created them? Another race of extraterrestrials in another galaxy millions of years away. It's just kind of, it's like a dog chasing his tail.
Sure, it's a snowball.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
But eventually, don't you have to get to this sole creator?
Well, that's the deal, isn't it? I mean, when Crick looked at the DNA, I mean, the only explanation he could come up with, as does Dawkins, when Ben Stein in his movie Expelled sits down with Richard Dawkins and poses the same question, Dawkins basically gives the same answer with all due respect. He says, well, maybe, you know, in a far-off galaxy, millions of years ago, a race of extraterrestrials, you know, created us and seeded us here.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, who created them? And look, where I'm at, and I'll just state it openly, I believe that there is a supreme being. I believe in the ancient prophetic text that I travel in, and the guidebook of the supernatural, i.e. the Bible.
Whatever the supreme being may be.
Well, we get glimpses of it. That's the interesting thing about prophecy, is that it gives us a glimpse A glimpse. That might be a new glimpse.
Hey, you've got 3 hours to go here, LA.
There you go. It gives us a window. Prophecy gives us a window into something, someone, outside space-time as we know it, that calls out the future and does so with great specificity, with 100% accuracy. That's one of the main reasons why, you know, I profess to believe what I believe in.
Well, you know, my guest that I had last hour was talking about the reality of the mind and how the mind creates so many things. And it's real to us because we create it. Mm-hmm. But to others, it may not even be there. What if this whole thing, this entire universe, is a creation of our collective mind, and it's not even there? That'll be Watcher 6.
With special guest George North.
I will do that for you. But, I mean, who knows? Who knows? I mean, if even trying to think of a divine creator, even trying to think about it boggles the mind, doesn't it?
We can't. I remember when I was a kid, true story, I was like 11 years old. I lay in my bed at night and I go, okay. And kind of, you know, my father would take me in bed, read me a story, whatever. 11 years old, sitting there all alone in my little room, and I would go, okay, let's just clear the slate. Nothing exists, nothing at all. So if what happened before this happened, there was nothing. So what does nothing look like? It's not white, it's not black, it's not gray. What is nothing? And I would sit there and ponder that and think about it and attack that with an 11-year-old mind and finally break out in the cold sweat and kind of scream inwardly and go, okay, enough.
I have no answers. And you know what? You said 11 years old. That's exactly the age I started my epiphany.
There you go.
Same thing. Out-of-body experience, trying to figure out what it was, what was happening to me. Maybe people are sending us a message at that age, huh?
Well, it's sort of the age of where a human being awakens, isn't it?
I mean, sure is.
The bar mitzvah, confirmation, all those things, bat mitzvahs, age of awakening, even in primitive cultures, you know, 11, 12, 13 is when, that's when the stuff starts happening. Puberty happens. I mean, it's a major change. The boy becomes the man.
If they ever found DNA on some other solar system, other planets, some other system, I wonder how close it would echo ours and who we are.
It's interesting you should point that out. I probably shouldn't be tipping my hand on the radio like this, but you know, maybe someone will hear this and help me out here. I'm looking, and I haven't posted it yet. So this is a first. I am looking for someone to help me create a Freedom of Information request specifically to the Smithsonian Institute, but there are other places I would send this request. To allow us to examine the bones of the giants that they took from the mounds in central, in Ohio Valley, let's say, and other places at the turn of the 18th, 19th, 20th century. We know that they did that specifically in the 19th of the 20th century, right in there, not the 18th. They were found in the 18th, but specifically when the Smithsonian came in at the latter part of the 19th century into the 20th and confiscated the bones. Freedom of Information Act. All we want to do is look at the bones, examine the bones, take some DNA sampling of the bones, and find out what we're looking at here.
That could be phenomenal.
I'm trying. If anyone out there can help me with that, LA at lamarzulli.net, and shoot me an email. Let's get it done.
LA, tell me a little bit about what you think could be a cover-up to hide the existence of the Nephilim.
That ties in with the last statements, doesn't it? We know, and some of this is the work of Fritz Zimmerman, but I took Fritz's book, and it's well-researched. It's called Nephilim in the Ohio Valley, The Nephilim Chronicles, Fallen Angels in the Ohio Valley. I mean, when I saw the title of the book, I about fell out of my chair. I couldn't believe it. And I've talked to Fritz. I'm actually going to interview him in about 10, 15 days. We're going to do a one-on-one tour of the mounds together. He's also speaking at a conference that I'll be speaking at in Ohio called Nephilim Mounds Conference. Gee, what a coincidence. And it's just fascinating. I can't wait to really pick his brain. But, you know, he had all these, I guess he lives in, I forget which state, I think it's Indiana. He lives near a government place where you can go, and it's got one of the greatest microfish libraries in America. In fact, all the microfish is sort of assembled there. So he's able to go in and just look at all these old newspaper records. And what he did is he started to discover that in the specifically in the mid latter part of the 19th century into the 20th century, as settlers pushed west and people began to examine the mounds, they found the bones of the giants. And the giants were, but the smaller ones were 7 to 8 feet. The larger ones were 12 feet and taller. Six fingers, double rows of teeth, red hair. So we're not in Kansas anymore at this point. Something else is going on. And I read story after story after story. Get this. A couple of those stories were right out here in our backyard, George. Catalina Island.
Yeah.
Santa Rosa Island. I about fell out of my chair when I read that. I've since, after we've read those, I've opened up a venue, or not a venue, but I've opened up a dialogue with a gentleman who actually wrote a book, Jim Watson, about the history of Catalina. And when I was doing some research, I've now spoken to Jim and found out that there was this guy on Catalina by the name of Glidden, somehow related to the Glidden Paint Company, who in the early part of the 20th century, 1920s, 1930s, right around in there, had permission from Wrigley, who basically owned Catalina at the time, to exhume the mounds. And he did this. And I've got one shot of a postcard of the actual so-called museum. There's rows and rows and rows of skulls and bones openly displayed. And this guy sent them to other traders. Well, here's the deal. This guy Glidden talks about unearthing bones of giants. And these giants appear to have been in some sort of a battle. Now, here's the rub, getting back to answer the question. It's always the same thing, or the same scenario, I should say. When these bones are found, word gets out, and the Smithsonian or a group of officials come and take the bones, and they are never seen again.
Why the secret, though? Hide it?
You know why? And I've asked Jed Burton this. I've asked Joe Taylor this. Joe Taylor is the curator of the Mount Blanco Museum. It's the iconic picture of the sort of grizzled old prospector guy with the battered hat standing next to this huge giant replica of a Nephilim bone. It's an iconic picture. And we interviewed Joe, Richard and I, for Watchers 4. It was just a fascinating interview. And both Joe and Judd Burton said, and I repeat, that when you have these bones, it completely goes against the Darwinian theory. These guys are not supposed to exist. They don't know where they came from. They're certainly not Native Americans. They're something else.
Mm-hmm. They're not of this planet.
No. Well, they're not entirely human. There's something else going on.
There's something there.
Yeah.
There's something there. That's fascinating. It truly is. I want to talk with you about rock wall when we come back.
Sure.
And some other areas. And we're going to get into your prophecies as well. And how's Dr. Lear feeling, by the way? I know
I mean, I don't know how much time we have before break.
About 30 seconds.
Okay,
you want to wait?
We interviewed him down at Seal Laboratory for Watchers 5. Unbelievable. I mean, what an afternoon. He's doing better.
Good.
He looked great.
That's good. We don't want to lose that guy.
No, no way.
He's too important.
Yeah, Roger's like my favorite uncle.
L.A., where do we get Watchers 4, by the way?
You can go to lamarzulli.net, www.lamarzulli.net. The trailer's up there, by the way, George, so people can...
Sure
is. Taste of what they're getting into. But Richard and I just love doing what we're doing, and we just keep cranking them out because there's so much to talk about.
Well, you sure do, and you do a great job doing that.
Thank you, sir.
Well, let's come back. Let's talk more about the Nephilim, talk about these giants. We'll also get into some of your thoughts about prophecy tonight. Our special guest, L.A. Marzulli, we're talking about his work, Watchers 4, On the Edge. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're going to talk a little bit about precognition on our next Coast to Coast show, followed by those Friday night into Saturday morning open lines when we come back. More with L.A. Marzulli as we talk about Watchers 4 on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, L.A. Marzulli as well. L.A., these giants again, are they the ones, of course, that were the offspring of those that came down here with the daughters of man?
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole Genesis 6. It's also found in the Book of Enoch, a pseudepigraphical book, fancy word meaning someone else wrote it, but it's attributed to Enoch. I mean, if you were going to keep any book away from the populace, that's the book you want to keep. That book, the Book of Enoch, has so much information in it, George. It's just mind-blowing. You talk about protocols. I mean, this thing gives protocols like and opens up a vista that's just not there, in, unfortunately, in the Genesis 6 account. It mirrors the Genesis 6 account, but it amplifies it and adds to it in ways that are just absolutely profound. Like, it actually names some of the Watcher angels, what they did, the fact that there was a quid pro quo, there was a trade, something for something. The men gave them access to the women. For that, they got weapons, or albeit they were primitive weapons, but they got weapons, metallurgy. They were shown different secrets. It's unbelievable. And some of that, you know, you can say, well, gee, isn't that interesting? Sort of the same thing happened, supposedly, the Truman years, right, when they made a deal, or the Eisenhower years, right, they made a deal. Yeah, you can have access to the population. You can abduct some of the people. Just give us one of those ships. There's such a similarity there. It's just kind of mind-blowing.
Maybe so. Let's get back to that that site and what's going on there. I mean, what did they find? Just one bone, a skull? What'd they get?
Well, the whole thing about rock wall, and this blew Richard and I completely away. You know, we went down to Texas, and by the way, when we were going to rock wall, we were in the Dallas airport, and Richard goes in to get a car, and I'm out there with Rob Skiba, our guide. And Richard calls me on the phone. He goes, get in here. Tornadoes are coming. And I go, what? So we hop out of the car. It's hailing at this point. We go running in. Cops are there, you know, airport police. We're like in this huge glass, three-story glass building, all glass in the front. And he's got everybody herded to the back. I'm saying to myself, my gosh, if a tornado hits this thing, we're going to get
cut. That's what happened in St. Louis. They're still trying to repair part of the terminals.
Exactly. And we sit there and watch this thing. Get this. Our plane, we left from Lubbock, Texas. Our plane was an hour and a half late. If our plane had been on time, we had left on time, we would have rented the car and driven to Rock Wall. We would have been in Rock Wall when the tornado hit.
Yeah.
So as fate has it, we're not. And, you know, anyway, we get to Rock Wall. We've done all the research. We've talked to this gentleman who's sort of an amateur archaeologist who actually conducted a dig at the site on Rock Wall. We've interviewed him. Now we go out to the site. We're like all hyped up. We've seen his pictures. We've seen his drawings. We've seen the samples from the wall. We get to the town, and no one knows where the rock wall is. And we're sitting there looking at each other going, you got to be kidding me. We go to City Hall. I walk in, and I go, hey, I'm, you know, L.A. Marzulli. We're here doing some research. We've heard about this rock wall. We'd really like to see it. The lady at the desk kind of looks at me and goes to her coworker, do you know what he's talking about? And I'm sitting there going, you got to be kidding me. Anyway, finally, cut to the chase. This gentleman comes out and explains to us that all this, get this, George, that all the sites that were once exposed are now covered over.
Oh, really?
All the sites have been covered over.
On purpose, of course.
Well, something's going on.
Yeah.
And I think it's the courthouse is built on this huge cavern. They know the cavern is there. The courthouse is built over this huge cavern that some people believe, you know, here we go again, the bones of the giants and all this other stuff.
And you said something about how they may have died earlier. Was it a war? What happened?
Well, that was a different site. That was the Catalina site with Santa Rosa.
Okay.
There seems to be a war between two different tribes of giants. You know, we've heard that there was on Santa Rosa when they went out there, apparently, according to this newspaper article, I think it's dated from the early, you know, 1900s or the late 1800s, but it's very old. And it talks about these bones are just, there was some kind of battle, and the bones are just like bleached white skeletons on, you know, on the sand, just laying there. And, you know, my thing is like, okay, where are they? Who's got them? And why can't we look at them? And by the way, on the break, I've already gotten three emails from people offering to help work on a Freedom of Information Act. So that's sort of interesting.
Excellent.
See where all that goes.
Excellent. Okay, so now tell us about the Ohio Mounds.
Well, look, when I went out to the Ohio Mounds,
been all over the place.
Well, yeah, we've done a lot of traveling. You know, we're constantly researching and looking and trying to get sort of to the bottom of this thing. And again, this is the work of Fritz Zimmerman, and you know, I'm just kind of tagging along for the ride here. But I've branched out. You know, I've taken Fritz's work sort of as a springboard. And now I'm branching out into my own research. But when I was at the Ohio Mounds, I was first struck by the enormity of the site. If you've never been to the Circle Mound and the Great Octagon Mound, it is a huge megalithic site. And these mounds are the largest mound works on the planet, as far as I know. You don't get a bunch of people who are hunter-gatherers. Let's look at this thing. Let's examine it with all due respect to Native Americans. How do you support a group of people to go out and labor and move dirt, what, with clamshells and baskets, and create moats and channel water, and the sophisticated astrological alignment which these mounds are on? For instance, the Octagon Mound, every 18.6 years, the lunar solstice, during the summer solstice, the full moon comes up right over the octagon, every 18.6 years, right in the center of the octagon. How did they know that? Who figured that out?
Yeah.
And guess what, George? You really can only appreciate the mounds from the air. When you're down in them, they're huge.
It's like the Nazca lines.
Same thing.
That kind of thing.
Same thing. When you're in it, you're kind of looking around. And this was like a huge ritualistic site. Now, get this. They've also found, and all this is sort of hushed up, but you dig a little deeper, no pun intended, and you find out that these sites are ritualistic sites. Human remains, which they appear to be human sacrifices, were done on these sites. Zimmerman believes, as I do. Now, get this. This is like in Genesis 6, right? It talks about the Nephilim. The Nephilim were on the earth, and then it says, and also afterwards.
Well, see, and obviously something was going on. You know, even if you believe half of Genesis, it's still telling you something was happening.
Mm-hmm. No, look, absolutely. There's something going on here, and it says, and also afterwards. The giants were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards.
That's right.
When the sons of God, the Bnei Elohim, came into the daughters of men, and we know the rest of the story. So you fast forward a couple of thousand years from the days of Noah, and you get Joshua and the crew going into what is known as the Levant, or the Promised Land. And the spies come back and go, oh, my gosh, we can't go in there. We saw the giants there. We were like grasshoppers in their sight. And they bail, and they don't go in. 40 years later, they finally go in. A mandate is given. Get this. This is huge stuff. A mandate is given. When you go in, wipe everything out. And the first thing someone says is, wait a minute, where's the loving God? Why is he telling these guys to wipe everybody out? What are we looking at here?
Yeah.
You know? And this is, if you don't plug the Nephilim in, then we serve, or we're looking at this genocidal, homicidal, capricious deity up there that just, well, I don't like these guys because, you know, they're green or whatever. But that's not the case. They're tainted. They're literally what I would call hybrids. They're demonic hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the giants, Zimmerman believes, as I do, saw what was going on, saw the conquest, and they left. They fled. And they fled northward. And eventually they came down into the Ohio Valley. This is almost 3,000 years ago.
How tall do we think they were, based
on
the
skeletons? The skeletons pulled out of the mounds are between 8 and 12 feet tall. So they're not, you know, the Goliath was like 15 feet tall. Some people believe 15 feet tall.
That David killed.
Yeah, David and Goliath. Goliath was about 15 feet tall, between 12 and 15 feet.
Well, that was a true giant.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And remember, you're looking at the Incredible Hulk. Something, I mean, this is what people don't get. If my theory is correct, and others, you know, I have colleagues that we all write this, like Dr. I.D.E. Thomas and Tom Horn, and, you know, guys like that. If we're correct, then not only are they giants, but they're like the Incredible Hulk. They have demonically enhanced, supercharged strength. They are like, you know, like superheroes, except they're incredibly malevolent.
Wait, okay, all right. That's important
if we're
to know.
Right.
That's important to know. How many of them do you think there might have been?
Thousands.
Wow. Are there any left?
That's a really good question. My gut feeling is no. And the reason for this is, and this is where it gets, and I'll say it again because I know I've got an audience out there. Anybody can help me out with this because I've just hit nothing but stone walls. I've gone to the Chumash elders, or let's put it this way. The Chumash Indian tribe is one of the predominant First Nation people in the area that I live in the Santa Monica Mountains, Southern California. Total stonewall. Couldn't get anybody even talk to me about it. It's like the door is slammed. All I'm trying to do is find out what they know, what their stories say about the giants. We know, for instance, that the Paiutes, Steve Quell talks about this, but other researchers have talked about it. And, you know, he's drawing from information that was given down, you know, well over 100 years ago. The whole Paiute legend of a tribe of giants and the Paiutes fought them and finally killed them off. We keep hearing the same story over and over and over again through different tribes throughout the Americas. They were here.
That's an amazing story.
They were here.
Are other people, I know Steve Quayle talks about giants as well, L.A., are other people beginning to research this?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are not, look, there's very few field researchers. I mean, for instance, I'll be going out to Catalina in October and meeting with my contact out there to discuss what he knows. And he's already talked about being able to look at Glidden's journals, where he documents where he found these bones and the length of the bones and the giant skeletons and all this. So we're also, I probably shouldn't be saying this, but I will. Apparently, he traded in some of these bones. Now, get this. If that's true, some of these bones may still be in private collectors. Our goal is to get DNA testing on these things, just
yes,
like the Star Child skull.
Absolutely.
Same thing.
Yep. You've got to find out.
Got to find out what we're looking at here.
And you can imagine the rest of these bones sequestered somewhere.
Well, Glidden's cache, apparently, is in the University of Southern California, if I'm not mistaken. That's where they're located.
In boxes, hidden away? What?
Well, this is, again, I've sent a request. So far, it has not been answered. All this moves in academia, everything moves incredibly slowly. And if you're not part of the club, it's very hard to break in unless you know somebody, unless someone can kind of take you in. Just like the Smithsonian, you know, we've heard stories, and again, they're apocryphal stories. I can't vet them. They're colorful. They make for great radio, but I can't vet any of them.
That's right.
We've heard stories from several sources that the Smithsonian has actually taken some of these bones and dropped them out in the middle of the ocean.
Got rid of them?
Got rid of them.
That would be sad and tragic.
Well, you know, again, that's a colorful story. It's a shocking story. I can't vet that. It could be all hearsay. It could be absolute poppycock, balderdash. But we don't know.
But if this was happening, again, you say it's because of, you know, evolution. They don't want to break that chain.
If the Nephilim are real and we can prove that, now we've got a real conundrum, because it breaks the whole Darwinian slow evolution over millions of years.
And Genesis is true, then.
Well, that's the deal, isn't it?
Yep.
Isn't it? I mean, if we can prove that the Nephilim are on the earth, and we can really show this, I mean, it begs the question, and I read Childress's book, Nephilim Skulls. I have it in my library.
Yeah.
Fascinating book. Fascinating book, and I'd love to talk to you. Maybe we'll get him in for Watcher 6, but the enigma of cranial deformation, and he talks about the head binding, okay? But then he's got pictures, and I love what he talks about in his book. He says, hey, guess what? In Peru, there is no Smithsonian Institute, so you can go there and you can see the skulls. And then he says something which is kind of alarming. He goes, oops, but recently the skulls that were on exhibit now all of a sudden in the back room. So maybe some, and I'm a conspiratologist, but maybe someone is getting at them, and that's sort of what, you know, Childress sort of hints at in his book. The same thing. It's like, well, you know, last time I was here, I got to look at these things, and now they're in the back room.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why can't the public see them? It's the same thing in the Americas. Why can't we see what is our right to see as American citizens?
You know, that's why I would hope that we would truly find Noah's Ark.
Oh, man.
These would echo. If these stories begin to echo Genesis, you know, the parting of the Red Sea and things like that,
mm-hmm.
I mean, then it's all got to be true.
Well, look, let me address the Noah thing, because I was talking to my friend Gary Sturman, who I know, you know, time travels with the Bible. He's been on your show.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had him up for dinner tonight. He's out here vacationing, and we had a wonderful dinner with his wife, Doris, and stuff. And we were talking, coincidentally, there are no coincidences, about Noah's Ark. And Kornuk is up there, and they think they've discovered this thing. It's down about 50 feet in the ice, and they've taken, I forget the name of the machine, but the what it does is it takes boiling water and melts the ice. And they truly believe that they've discovered where the ark is. It's down 50 feet embedded in the ice, and it's been there for, like, you know, obviously thousands of years. What's interesting, though, George?
Amazing.
You know, those are artifacts, and those artifacts, like, you know, like finding an ephod, the breastplate of the high priest, or the Ark of the Covenant,
right.
All those things would be just be mind-blowing. But what I find even more mind-blowing is the fact that there's this thread of prophecy all through, you know, the guidebook of the supernatural, i.e. the Bible, which talks about, and it does so with great specificity, what's going on in the world right now. Not to change subjects, but I mean that to me is just, whoa, wait a minute. But I agree. Look, we start finding some of these artifacts, we can get a Nephilim bone. That's, you know, that's going to, okay, what are we looking at here? Is this an anomaly? Is this like Cro-Magnon? Is this something else? What if it has different DNA like the Star Child? What if the DNA is not entirely human? Now what?
And then it points out to me, if it's all true, then the book of Revelation has got to be true.
Yeah, and
if that's
true, that's
scary.
We're getting awful close to it.
Too close.
Yeah, I agree.
Too close. What's the great deception?
Well, in my opinion, and I've written about this, you know, in all my books and stuff, we've never really covered it so much in Watchers, because Watchers is a different platform, different media. But in my book, specifically Politics, Prophecy, the Supernatural, and even the Cosmic Chess Match, Darwin sort of sets up this intellectual and spiritual vacuum in a person. If we all evolve, then if the thing about this, travel here, the audience, that if we all just evolved, then there are no moral absolutes. I mean, you can really do whatever you want to do. There are no absolute rights or wrongs. It's what we perceive, and what's fine for you might not be for someone else, and vice versa. There is no God. There's no right or wrong. No evil. No good. There's just mindless evolution. And, you know, all we're here to do is procreate the species and to keep evolving. It makes no sense. That creates, Darwinism sort of creates this moral and spiritual vacuum, in my opinion, in a person. So what we see with movies like Prometheus, we see this played out. We have this trillionaire who wants to find his creator, wants to find out who made him. And they're out in space without giving the whole movie away. And they find these race of giants, isn't that interesting, who allegedly created them, seeded us here, panspermia.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Dawkins, who's an ardent evolutionist. When Stein holds his feet to the fire, all he can say is maybe. If you haven't seen that clip, it's an awesome clip when Ben Stein sits down with Richard Dawkins and says, okay, where's the first, you know, self-replicating molecule come from? Dawkins has no clue. And Stein presses him, and finally Dawkins says, well, you know, maybe a race of extraterrestrials who had to have evolved to a very high, sophisticated level, you know. But how did they get there? The circular reason we talked about earlier. This sets up the intellectual vacuum. So when they show up, get this now, when they show up, there are millions of people who will embrace them, who will look at them and go, you are our creators. It's exactly
that's
like
that. That's right. Guy. Let's talk more about that, L.A., when we come right back on Coast to Coast Plus. What happens when you die? Prophecy, and of course, the Mark of the Beast.